You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. And this is, I mean, I was going to say it's an episode from the archives, but that would suggest it had been released before. This is K. Trevor Wilson, who you will know as Squirrelly Dan from Letterkenny, or as a brilliant, brilliant comedian in his own right, with one of the most infectious and warm laughs in comedy. We recorded this episode, maybe, I'm going to say 2017. I'm just going to plant a flag in the timeline and say this was in Montreal in 2017. And it went missing and it ended up on a hard drive somewhere. I came back with bundles of content. I never found it. I never released it. And I am absolutely thrilled that in the ongoing project to rescue and organize the archive into some sort of form in order to, God knows, make one of five different types of books about stand-up, all of which remain hypothetical at the moment. I've been organising and I found this. K. Trevor Wilson is an absolute love. And in these days, if you don't know him from Letterkenny, you've got to watch Letterkenny. You can find it on YouTube if you're in the UK. I don't think it's ever officially come out on telly here. But at the time of recording, it was very much in its infancy and now is on its 10th season. I think they just finished their 10th season last year. It's really worth checking out and you will finally understand who that guy is from a bunch of memes, because it's one of those shows that's gone on to live. I mean, I see it on imgur.com all the time. It has a life outside of simply being a show. It has entered the public discourse, has everything these days. Let's not get bogged down in meme chat. We're going to talk about getting comic mileage out of incidents for the sake of long-form storytelling, finding out, figuring out who you are on stage. We're going to talk about loving the road and desiring a normal life at the same time and whether that's possible. No extra content on this one, but you can go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for ad-free episodes and all the extra content from every show that has any. So this, without further ado, is the wonderful K. Trevor Wilson. At long last! So, K. Trevor? I call you K. Trev, and I believe other
most,
people
most people do call me K. Trev, but my real name is just Trevor.
The K is my middle initial...
transplanted to the front because there was another Trevor Wilson.
But could you not have gone Trevor K. Wilson, or is that not?
Yeah, I could have. But my agent was like, you know, there's a lot of middle initials, but there's no one really doing the front initial.
No one's doing the back. You could have done Trevor Wilson K.
Yeah. I think the K would have been easier to lose at the end.
Good point. I'll call you Trevor for the rest of this, but I do enjoy having a friend called K. Trev.
It is, the K stands for Kingsley, which is my middle name.
Oh, nice!
And my grandfather's name. It was just, it turned out to be an accidentally good marketing tool, because there's lots and lots of Trevor Wilsons, but I'm the only K. Trevor Wilson I've found so far. So
nice.
It helps direct that internet traffic.
Okay.
So important traffic.
So I have heard your album, Sex Cop Fire Penis.
Oh, nice.
Which I enjoyed immensely. Thank you. I should say is available on iTunes and wherever else people want to buy their albums. When did you record that?
2014.
Okay.
Yeah. It was actually in between, recorded like end August, beginning of September, in between JFL and JFL 42. which is the Toronto Just for Laughs, and I did it in Kingston, Ontario, which is actually directly in between Montreal and Toronto. So I was originally going to call the album Between Festivals, but then someone was like, that's a really asshole title.
Yeah, I like the joke, but I could see how it would look like guys.
So I called it Sex Cop Fire Penis instead, which is pretty much what the album's about.
Yeah, yeah, true enough.
I touch on all those subjects.
Yeah.
I thought of the word fire penis and then was like, geez, what could go with fire penis? And, oh, sex cop. And we've hit all the nails on the head.
Now, the way I describe you to people, and I believe, I mean, I know from your own bio, you're known as the Man Mountain, or the self-proclaimed Man Mountain of Canadian comedy. And of course, on seeing you downstairs a couple of days ago for the first time, I was like, Trevor, you're already half there. the way I describe you to people is like this huge bearded barrel chested monster with a heart of gold. Like,
oh,
that's,
thank you.
Yeah, well, that's how I see you. You're unlimited, you know, because we've bumped into each other only at this festival over the last couple of years. We will maybe get onto the changes to that image that you're making with your physical, your dietary changes that you're doing at the minute. Where's a good starting point? I really enjoyed the album, and what I enjoyed most about the album was the freshness of the voice that you have. I felt like I hadn't heard anyone tell stories like that in a voice like yours.
Oh, right on. Thanks.
Oh, you're very welcome. Do you feel different amongst your peers? Do you feel like... Are you aware of the difference in the voice that you're bringing to the stage?
Yeah. I don't know anyone else doing really what I do.
For the benefit of people who don't know you, how would you describe what you do? And I know that's a hideous question to ask a comic, but here you can spend a bit of time actually explaining what it is.
For the most part, I'm a long-form storyteller. And even when I do jokes, they're all long form bits. Some of the cuts on Sex Cop Fire Penis are, you know, 8 minute long. I had to split one bit into two because it was like almost a 20 minute bit on one subject. And so definitely not too many guys in North America doing, you know, that much long form story. There's a joke in Toronto that the last thing you want to hear is K. Trevor Wilson say, I'm just going to do one more before I go. It's like, that's off. Oh, we're going over. I take a topic and I beat it to death. I get as much, material as I can out of my premise. I'm a big believer that jokes aren't ever finished. We just get them to a place that we like them on stage. And it's why I've only recorded one album and I've been doing this almost 17 years is because I don't really know if I've ever finished any of my jokes, because I'll tell them 100 times the same way. And then the 101st time I'll think of something I'd never thought of before and pop it in to see if it works. And yeah, it was actually weird to retire all the jokes on Sex Cop Fire Penis, because it was like admitting that they were finally finished.
Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be a weird moment. I mean, one of the things I really like about the comic voice that you have is you are essentially, I don't know if optimistic is the right word, but your good nature is really imbued in a lot of that stuff. Do you see what I mean?
I try to be pleasant. I enjoy what I do. It's that's my favorite part of the day, is the joke telling part. So I'm quite happy. I know some people it's their therapy and it's their time to vent and rant and get all their venom out. But for me, I'm just quite happy to be there. I just got some funny jokes I'd like to say. And I'm pleased to do it.
And it's not just the... that's clear. Absolutely. I totally agree with your assessment of that. But it's not just the fact that you're enjoying yourself on stage.
there's sort of there's just a flavour to what you're talking about. If we look at one of the, what, remind me what the opening story. I remember what the closing story was, but remind me the opening section on Sex Cop.
The opening section on Sex Cop. I think I start into being the overweight and single is probably the
yes.
The early stuff on Sex Cop. I do the roofie joke.
Yes, you've roofied yourself.
Where I've roofied myself. Which, because I'm the... That joke works, too, because I'm probably the slowest talker in stand-up comedy right now. Like I take my fucking time. I was getting roasted once, and the guy was like, it's not a foot race. You can fucking try to hurry up. And then I start into a lot of silly... But not even self-deprecating, because I talk about being awesome for being fatter than everybody, actually.
Yeah.
I have a bit about fat guys being better lovers, because we're soft and squishy, like pillow foam.
I think what I'm remembering is the mugging story.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so like there's the introductory setup, there's the this is who you are. And then where we really get a sense of who you are is, I think it's such a brilliant piece of work, this self-contained story where almost every line in it is funny. Every line is a new, like a kind of not exactly a development of the character that you're portraying, but it's like a reveal of the richness of the character. When you talk about just being poor, being stoned, and getting mugged and having them steal your pager. You know, and it's like every kind of section of it.
It's the saddest robbery for both people involved.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because it's like I was not in a situation where I could really afford to get robbed. And they got so little out of all of that effort. Like, it was just everyone came out with the shit end of the stick. Part I don't talk about on stage because it's not really funny, but is absolutely true, is I had all my roommates' rent money in my backpack at the time, in a hidden pocket, and I was going to deposit my rent money. So I had $20 in my wallet, which I happily gave them because I had about $2,000 in a pocket in my backpack.
That you got away with?
That I got away with.
Fuck yeah! Yeah. Right.
Because when I opened up my backpack, it was just full of my chef clothes because I was working at a kitchen at the time. So they were like, what's in the backpack? I'm like, my laundry. You want my dirty fucking chef pants? And they're like, no, you can keep those. I'm like, well, thank God they didn't go reaching underneath the dirty chef pants. There was $2,000 in there. For all you criminals out there, you know, like, look deeper. Don't just look at the surface. You're not doing security at the Just for Laughs Walk Around Festival. Poke around in that bag. You'll find some things.
Yeah. So the meter of that story, is that like how long were you telling that story?
That happened, it was a few years out of college. So I was in my mid-20s when I started sort of figuring out how to make it funny on stage. Because it definitely killed at parties. It was just one of those stories that I had to find out how to make it work. But it probably a good 7 years.
Okay.
Of doing that bit and developing it, and because it just kept, because I started doing the bit when I got mugged, and then the 6 months later, like, you know, it happened 6 months later, and it was one of those great moments where I already had like the start of a really good bit, and then I got a phone call from the police asking me if I had any new information, and in my head I was like, this is the ending.
Yeah, great.
This is what I've been looking for.
Start secretly recording the conversation.
Thank you, officer, for giving me the fucking button on this joke. It's funny because after a while, as a stand-up, that's really how you start looking at life situations sometimes. You know at some point you're in the middle of a bit and you've got to sit here and see how this finishes. Because you're not letting someone else get this joke.
Yeah, and like no one's joke ever contains. So then I waited to see what would happen.
Yeah.
So that it would make good material.
Yeah. You can't say that, but like said secretly, what we're all doing half the time, it's like, fuck, this could be good. Like,
so that So talk to me about the development of that piece. So you said it killed at parties. So it's kind of like you're a... Is that a common thing for you, that you would kind of... You would work out what you're talking about socially? Do you mean you'd become aware that something you were talking about socially was funny?
Yeah, I think I was always using the people around me as a sounding board. And I still do. Like, when I get an idea, I bounce it off people, especially if it's like about them, you know, or if they're involved in the story, then I start, you know, making the jokes with them first to see if it's, to see if they laugh. And if they laugh, then I can do it on stage. Because okay. You admitted it's funny, so you can't take that back.
Okay. Yeah. Right. That's a nice way of doing it. So you've got there, you've kind of, finagle them into...
They've accidentally admitted that they like it. But it was just one of those things, because, like, it was in like, the local paper that a local guy had been mugged, like...
Okay.
And, I mean, the you know, it was at my parents' place. I actually, in the bit, I say it was back at my place, but I got mugged in my parents' neighborhood, and I was living in a different part of Toronto at the time, and my parents lived in, like, a pretty well-off... mostly white part of Toronto, and I got, at the time I was living in like Little Jamaica. It was like a very multicultural part of Toronto where it's like my neighbors were all Italian, Portuguese, and Jamaican immigrants for the most part. And it was also a neighborhood that used to be super Irish. So there was also this like weird old angry Irish contingent who were pissed off that everybody who'd moved in, like they were really sore that it wasn't Irish anymore. And that was supposed to be like a really like everybody warned me about, you know, where I was living. Like, oh, that's a dangerous part of the city. And like, I never had any problems in my neighborhood. Like everyone just, you know, I'm a giant white guy. And so if I'm walking around, most people assume I'm supposed to be there. But it was one of the joys of being about 300 pounds most of your life. People don't know if you're tough, but they don't want to find out.
Yeah, sure. So
everyone was just really nice. You know, a lot of neighborhoods that get bad raps are still full of very nice people for the most part. And, you know, the problems I ever had with my neighbors is an old Italian guy who thought we were sabotaging his zucchini. He was just crazy. But yeah, so I got mugged in my parents' neighborhood by kids that had probably driven up expecting to roll like a rich white person. And they found a cook finishing up his shift and walking home. And I immediately after getting mugged went to the bar that I say in the story. And it was like the local bar. It was karaoke night. I sang some songs to make me feel better. And like, I know everyone there. So I was like, I just got fucking mugged. I started telling them all the story. And they were the first person, you know, that I really started bouncing it off of. Cause you know, as in anything, especially if it's a stressful situation, you make it funny. So it's less stressful. And so I was cracking jokes about it, and just like everything about it lent itself to a bit. Like the experience getting mugged was so weird, and then the experience with the cops was so weird, and then my favorite part was like it got written up in like the Guardian, the Etobicoke like local paper, like the free paper you get at the grocery store, and in the little note they mentioned that they'd taken my pager, $20, and my cigarettes. And when I told the story to my mom, I didn't tell her that they took my cigarettes. So my mom reads the Guardian, and then the next time I see her, she's got a snarky look on her face, and she goes, "You saw the thing in the Guardian about your mugging. So we're still smoking, are we?" That's what you took from that?
So talk to me about your background. So what's the name of the town that you...
Well, I grew up in Toronto. Etobicoke is like a borough, almost. Like it's okay. the village of Etobicoke. It used to be its own municipality, but then it was just absorbed into Toronto and is part of the greater Toronto area. But it's like, yeah, the Toronto mayor is the mayor of Etobicoke now. So it's Toronto proper. But when I was a kid, it was its own separate, you know, city, technically Etobicoke, which is just, you know, we're attached by the subway to Toronto. We're in between Toronto and Mississauga. And yeah, it's like, I lived in a pretty white, well-off neighborhood. We were like the not rich family. I can't say that we were poor, but we were definitely the not the richest family in our neighborhood. Like, none of my siblings got cars as gifts, whereas that happened for some of my friends.
Okay.
You know, yeah. When I wanted a television, I had to get a job and buy it, whereas other people, it was the birthday gift.
Sure. Yeah. What did your folks do?
My dad was a stockbroker and financial planner, and my mom had been a teacher, but when they started having kids, she just became a full-time mom. And there was, you know, four of us, so we kept her pretty busy. I'm the second of four.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember wanting for everything, but I do remember seeing cooler shit on other lawns, like...
And you were a child actor at one point.
Yeah, I got into the business, I guess, kind of early when I was about 13, 14. I'd been doing school plays and, like, drama classes at the Young People's Theater in Toronto. And that's what I always had an affinity for. I was a big John Candy fan. And when I was seven, I figured out that was his job.
Okay, yeah.
Like, it all sort of clicked in what jobs were. And I was like, why do some people get to be in movies and some people don't? Like, you know, as a kid, you don't understand it. You know, first, you got to realize none of this is real. And then you got to figure out that that's what a job is. And I was like, that's got to be the best job ever. So I really wanted to do that. And so I started doing, like, you know, kid acting classes and got into a performance arts high school. The Etobicoke School of the Arts. And I was actually in my first year at high school. I was in ninth grade, but I'd gone back to my grade school to help them with a production of Much Ado About Nothing they were doing. And they'd asked me to come in and play Dogberry because I'd had a bit of experience with Shakespeare before and could help, you know, some of the younger kids who were going to have a tough time getting their tongues around this for the first time. And one of the girls was already working professionally in the school. Her parents actually, like, put on the shows. They were her mom was a bit of, you know, like, classic stage mom. Like, all three kids had been in the, like, were in the business. And
okay.
I believe at one point she had aspirations of acting, and her and her husband put on the school productions every year. So her agent had come to see her in it and saw me throwing myself down a flight of stairs for cheap laughs in the third act, and gave me a business card and got me started acting professionally. I think my first jobs were, I did a Canadian film company short called Day Pass about a guy who gets a day pass out of prison to go to a family function, and then decides he's going to cut out on the day pass and try to escape. And it's like a small town, like, family wedding, like the gal's already 7 months pregnant, and I played the older brother to the main character, who was a little kid who, like, maybe his father's son, but might actually be the uncle from prison's son.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
They're ambiguous on that. And I was the older brother who was just sneaking booze at any opportunity he had. And then my other job after that was Goosebumps on the kids' horror series.
Yeah, okay.
Based on the R.L. Stein novel. I worked for them twice as a teenager, and the first time was, I was cut out of The Haunted Mask Part 2, which was an hour-long Goosebumps special. And I played a bully, which made up most of my early resume.
Okay.
You know, I was a pretty big kid.
Like, sure. Were your siblings big kids as well?
Not as big as me. My brother's taller than me, but he's like really lean. He's got like a Michael Phelps build.
Okay.
And my sisters, I mean, both look like they could, you know, play some serious rugby. They're going to get mad at me if they ever hear this, but they're broad shoulders ladies. They could whip a guy into a fireman's carry. You know, my dad's a big guy, and my mom's a stocky lady. Like, you know, I wouldn't fuck with her. I'm still not 100% sure I could take my mom in a fight.
Okay.
She's got, like, old farm girl strength, and it's really weird. But, like, she'll grab you. And she knows she's your mom, so she knows all your pressure points and weaknesses. Like, there's still some times where I'll be, like, visiting my mom and dad, and she'll, like, grab me and pin me down because she thinks it's hilarious. And I'm like, part of me is like, ha, ha, ha. And part of me is like, fuck, am I going to have to help, like, help my mom to get out of this?
So you ended up playing a lot of bullies because you were a physically imposing kid.
Yeah, and I got this voice when I was, like, 13.
Yeah.
I went from a soprano in the school choir to this.
No way!
Like, overnight.
And it's not a smoking, shouting, heavy metal kind of...
No, ever since I'm 13, I've had this, like, it's gotten deeper. It's gotten fuller with the abuse I've done to it. But from pretty much since I was 13 on, I've had this, like, ridiculously deep man voice. And it aged me as a kid actor. It was hard to you know, buy me some roles. Like, you weren't going to have me be frightened teen because I did not sound very frightened. I just sounded surly.
Okay.
I was grumpy uncle child. So yeah, bullies was the perfect job for me to play. I did that a lot. I had a good 2 years where I did a lot of TV movies where I beat up the handicapped. That was my that was my typecast for a while. My grandma was always so upset by the roles I played because my mom would show her everything I did, and my grandma's show would be like, you know, I don't like it when you're so mean on the television. And, and I was like, well, you know, grandma, it's just a character I'm playing. They're paying me to play the bully. And she's like, well, you should tell them that you're nice.
Oh, that's very sweet. That's some classic grandmothering.
My other grandma was actually like a performer herself. She'd been, her and her twin sister were a song and dance team. And they started in their hometown of Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, the turn of the century. And
that's the most Canadian place I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't get much more Canadian than Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. It was named after the moose jaw that they found there when they built the town. And her and her twin sister, they actually learned dance by correspondence. A dance school in New York would send them this, like, folded-up mat, and they'd unfold it on their floor, and it would have all the dance steps plotted out for them, and that's how they'd learned their routines, was just going step, like a giant twister mat almost.
Okay.
And they performed, like, in and around Saskatchewan, and when they were 18, they did an Alaskan showboat cruise with a bunch of other performers, went up around the Alaskan coast, and they briefly had their own dance school in Vancouver, but sort of the Depression got rid of things like dance classes, and they pretty much performed for food and shelter for through the Depression years. You know, they you could barter entertainment for food and lodging back then, so they would, you know, tour around and
So different from contemporary stand-up comedy.
Yeah. And they do those, they actually told me a great story when I was a kid, and I never truly appreciated it till I was a comedian. But they had a ventriloquist on the showboat cruise that they did, and they were doing a show up probably around British Columbia, and the first two rows at the performance one night were filled by natives from the nearby reservation. And just two rows of, like, big, burly natives, and the ventriloquist is up there doing his routine, and the natives were stone-faced during the entire show, just no emotion, staring him dead in the eyes, the whole time he's doing his routine, and zero laughter. And he's sweating bullets. Like, he thinks he's going to get killed after the show. And after the show, a large group of Native men approach him, and he's quite frightened. And they come up and say, "We just wanted to let you know we really enjoyed your show." And he was like, "Well, that's wonderful, but why didn't any of you laugh?" And they said, "Well, we didn't want to interrupt."
Oh.
And he's like, "Well, next time, feel free to laugh."
Yeah.
"We will." And then they all laughed.
Oh, my Lord.
So this is Trevor, a joy to be around, a very, very funny man, and we will get back to him very soon. Now, I mentioned at the top of the show, no extras from this episode, but if you are inclined to support the show, and some people support the show and never get round, I see, every so often I log in and I see the back end, what we refer to as the back end, and I see that some people are supporting the show and not getting hold of the extra content, the ad-free episodes and all of the sort of Zoom specials that we've done with, like, opportunities for you to ask your comedy heroes questions, nor indeed the fabulous self-help for comedians special with real psychologist, real Amanda Donnett. But all of those things are available to you if you would like to support the show for just £2 a month or as much more than that as you can handle. Everyone gets the same stuff because, God damn it, we're trying to carve out some sort of niche for fairness in the world. Now, I'm going to chat to you in a little postamble at the end. Here is a little announcement, though. I'm off to South by Southwest in nary a week. Am I using the word nary correctly there? God knows. But I can now officially, for the first time, tell you that I'm going to be interviewing Jim Gaffigan, Dulcie Sloan, and Eddie Pepitone will return to this podcast. I'll try and fit in some additional peripheral chats while I'm there if I can. Those are my three biggie live ones. And Jim Gaffigan, you don't need me to tell you, he's absolutely enormous. What a huge, huge comic, and so, so funny. I was catching up with Mr. Universe, his special, I think from about 10 years ago now, on Spotify, and he has a new Netflix special out now. So jump on the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook group, which you can find by using your Verve imagination and ability to search for things, and get in there, jump on that post. I shall pin the post in just a moment, and you can send me your questions, please, for excellent stand-up Jim Gaffigan, excellent stand-up, and Daily Show correspondent Dulcie Sloan, who has one of the most incredible opening gambits in stand-up I think I've ever seen. More on that perhaps when I speak to her. And of course, Eddie Pepitone returned to the show. Cannot wait to talk to Eddie again. So go to the ComCom group, ask me your questions there, and get revising now. Oh, one final time. Just bloody do yourself a favour and watch Letterkenny, that's what I say. Now, that is all of that. I'll postamble at you at the end. You can follow Trevor Wilson, K. Trevor Wilson, to give him his full unreal name. You can follow him on Twitter, K. Trevor Wilson. On Instagram, K. Trevor Wilson. And who knows whether that dot's required, but you give it a razz. Or K. Trevor Wilson, all one word, .com. I mean, come on, it's a URL. They're always all one word, right? Back to Trevor.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
tell me about your, so the transition from acting to stand-up comedy. Did you ever see yourself being a stand-up when you were a kid? Did you, what were your kind of reference points for what stand-up was?
I'd always loved stand-up. I mean, I loved comedy in all of its forms, and as much as I liked acting, like, drama's easy compared to comedy. You know, give someone a disease, you're golden. Like, it's not hard to make people feel sad, but to make people feel happy well is a lot harder. So I'd always been... my dad did introduce me to comedy that I probably shouldn't have seen at an early age. Like, I think I was about 7 the first time he showed me Life of Brian.
Okay.
So, like, I was... And I don't know why, but I got it even when I didn't get it.
Yes. Like, there's something glorious about grown-ups being silly.
My dad always said that I had, like, an innate sense for what was funny. Like, when I was a kid watching shows with him, I was laughing at the appropriate parts.
Okay.
But there was no way that I would understand the reference that they were using.
It was just the rhythm was making you go, this should be a funny bit.
I didn't know why it was funny, but I knew it was funny. And that's why I think one of the reasons he started showing me stuff that I, you know, that you wouldn't normally show a kid, a child of 7, because it's like, well, he's going to get it, or he's going to laugh, so he's going to have fun. And... yeah, so I was obsessed with Saturday Night Live as soon as I discovered it. I'd stay up late, and if I couldn't stay up late, I'd tape it. On alternating weeks, I'd rent Eddie Murphy's stand-up, like either Raw or Delirious, and you know, sleep in the basement on the weekends and watch that over and over again. And I had, like, Stephen Wright and Robin Williams and George Carlin tapes and Bill Cosby tapes and anything that was comedy. I'd stay up late and watch A&E's because they had Evening at the Improv and Caroline's Comedy Hour. And
did you used to watch Just for Laughs?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could not. It was it's weird. I've been watching Just for Laughs my whole life, and it was another thing that was I never realized until I was in the business that not all the comedians were the same kind of famous.
Yeah, right. That's a really interesting observation, because I remember watching Just for Laughs as a kid, and that's part of why it's so exciting to be here now in this city with people everywhere, you know. And that's a really good point. I was just kind of like, look at all this stuff. This is what the rest of the world is enjoying. With exactly that, with no sense that, like, oh, this guy is a tryout first thing and this guy's been going 20 years.
Yeah, like, yeah, if you were on the show, I think in my head, you were all the same level of comedy famous. And I'd be like, oh, man, I remember starting out and going to comedy shows and, like, oh, man, I've seen that guy on Just for Laughs. Like, oh, my God, he's... That guy's going to be amazing, and I know this because I've seen him on Just for Laughs. And only the very best are on Just for Laughs. And then you meet people that you've been looking up to for years, and it's like, oh, man, you're, like, not much further ahead from me, and I just started.
Yeah. Or you see someone massive now, and you realize, oh, when I saw you then, that was, like, your first TV show and just your first TV spot, and you were freaking out about it.
Yeah, I was like, oh man, like, not everyone is the same kind of famous.
And are you ambitious? Did you, when you were watching that stuff as a kid, were you thinking, I want to do this and I want to be on TV doing this?
I knew I wanted to do it, and it just made sense to do it, like, on TV. I just assumed that was part of it. You know, when I was a kid watching it. And, you know, but being in the business since I was 14, of course, when I started stand-up, I wanted to get to the point where I was doing it on TV, because I already had a sense that I was in a business and that one hand could feed the other and that my acting could help my stand-up and my stand-up could help my acting. My only problem is I tried to do too many things. Like I had a sketch troupe for 10 years, called Smells Like the 80s. I'd been acting. I was doing stand-up, and then I had to have an actual job because none of those things pay very well.
What was your actual job? Was that when you were a cook?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I started out as a waiter, and then that made me hate people, and it was starting to affect my stand-up, so I became a cook, so I didn't have to talk directly to customers.
Why did it make you hate people?
Because people are awful. When I was a server working at a restaurant, like, so many times people would unload on their servers, and it's their fucking fault. Like, it's their bullshit. And I remember one lady, like, I came out a large table and I served them, and there was a couple and a shit ton of fucking kids, and I bring them all their food at the same time, and then probably like 15-20 minutes later the lady stops me and is like, my food is cold, take it back and get it reheated. And all I could think was like, well, yeah, it's cold now. It was hot when I brought it to you. Like, don't get mad at me because you had to chase around your shitty kids and didn't get a chance to eat your food when it was hot. Like, I'll gladly reheat it for you, but it's not my fucking fault your kids don't know how to behave, jackassers. And that's when I was a kid, I don't remember getting out of my chair and running around a restaurant. If you were lucky to be out, you sat the fuck down and pretended you were... Going out to dinner was the time you all had to pretend you were normal.
So you wanted to be in the kitchen to get away from the people. What was your reaction to situations like that? Were you getting angry with that woman? Were you having to kind of bite your tongue?
Well, no, like I knew that if I wanted a tip, I wasn't going to say anything. Like, you know, in my head, there's 300 things I'd love to tell that woman about how she's living her life, but I'm going to keep it inside and go to the kitchen and get her food reheated, because it's a service job. I was also heavily medicated, so...
What do you mean, in the sense of weed?
When I was working as a server, I was in the middle of a pretty big acid phase, so... Okay. I was expanding my horizons at that time. This was all very small and meaningless in the grand scope of hallucinogenics.
Okay, that's surprising me. I don't know if I had you pegged as a. And what is that? Was that from a desire to? I mean, people get into acid for lots of different reasons. One of them is boredom. Was it like, if you're a kind of small town Canadian guy, were you sort of bored with what was around you, or was it more?
No, because I was in Toronto. Like, I was in the biggest city in the country. I think it was just available. It was available and not really habit forming, and kind of. I mean, I wasn't doing it every day, but you know, more often than probably. Maybe once or twice a month I was, you know, dropping acid, and it helped me stay awake. I'd take acid and write college papers.
How did you do in college?
I got an 80% on a humanities essay.
I wrote High on Acid.
It was on whether new reproductive technologies fell under the humanistic or mechanistic paradigm of science.
Sounds pretty LSD.
yeah. I was like, this is a good paper for fucking drugs. And I argued they fell under the mechanistic, not because of the nature of the science, but because of the nature of the reaction to the science.
I don't understand the terms involved, but I understand the combination of words.
Yeah. I actually quoted George Carlin in my closing argument. George Carlin said, "Everything comes from nature. Man is part of nature. Therefore, everything we make came from nature." And like, sometimes in nature, you got to stab some monkeys in the eyes to cure some diseases.
So you were doing the cook. You're being a cook or a waiter to make money whilst doing your sketch troupe, whilst doing your stand up. And you said you feel now that you'd spread yourself too thin.
Yeah, because it was impossible to give enough time to any one thing. Because like, you're working in restaurants, so especially when I was going to school and trying to do all these things. But even when school's done, you're working in a restaurant, so you're if you're working day shifts, those are auditions you're not going to be able to go to. And when you're working night shifts, those are sets you're not getting under your belt. And then, you know, you're trying to give equal time to both. So you're trying to create a balance. And then you got a sketch troupe. So you got to make sure you're getting together, you know, at least once a week to write material. And then you got to rehearse the shit. And then, you know, truck everybody out, do a fucking show. And, like, you know, trying to organize a sketch troupe is like herding cats. It's impossible to do, and it relies on everybody being the exact same amount of motivated for it to really work. And as much as I love sketch and doing sketch, we couldn't keep there's three of us that stayed through the whole thing, but we kept losing members here and there. And as much fun as we had, eventually just got to a point where it was, you know, we got to make a decision. Are we going to keep fooling ourselves that they're going to want to remake Kids in the Hall with our sketch troupe?
Or, yes, okay, of course, Kids in the Hall were they were the Canadian Monty Python.
Yeah, there's, you know, you reach the wall and it's like, there's only so much we're going to do as a group.
Yeah.
You know, unless we all give everything we've got into this, and that's a big fucking gamble. So
even in a double act, that's hard.
Yeah,
let alone a big group.
So we all started, you know, a few years before we broke up, we were already, you know, going in our separate directions to do our own things, and it just sort of came to the realization that I had to pick something, because I hadn't put enough time into my stand-up career to really get very far. My acting, you know, I was getting good recurring spots here and there, but I still felt at a point where I hadn't caught up to my voice yet, even in my 20s. You know, like I played older than I was still. You know, I was a big, you know, weird-looking guy. I kept trying to change my look for a while there to sort of fit what was going, and then...
For acting work?
Yeah. And then I just said fuck it and stopped shaving and cutting my hair, and was like, if they want me to shave and cut it, I'll shave and cut it.
But yeah.
I'm just stopping trying to impress casting agents with haircuts. And I just realized that stand-up was the one I could control. Stand-up was, it relied on only me. There was you go at an audition and you never know who you're up against. You know, you never know what their story is or what they're really looking for on it. There's all these factors that you have no control over. So unless I wanted to, you know, write plays and star in them, or, you know, create some sort of vehicle for myself, the one thing I could control was stand-up. You're producer, director, writer, star. It's all you. If it works, it's all you. If it fails, it's all you. So I just threw myself, I put everything else on the back burner. I started working exclusively day shifts to leave every night free and just... started living in stand-up, you know, shows. I was, if I wasn't on, I was watching. You know, there was a time where I was doing, like, you know, I was doing at least one set every night.
That can't be easy in Toronto.
It wasn't at the time, no. Like, I was running around, like, there was a lot of shows, but not as many as there are now. And when I was averaging a show, and I was doing 3-4 sets, you know, on some nights, which was like tough to do. I was driving out of town. I'd borrow my parents' car to give comics a lift for stage time. Just anything I could do to get in front of people and get more experience. And just devoted myself to becoming a stand-up. And It took probably about 7 years after I made that decision to, like, well, I shouldn't say to make that, because, like, 7 years after I was like, okay, stand up is the one I'm focusing on. And then I got my first festival about 3 years after going to day shifts, like just having the nights completely free for stand up.
When you say you got your first festival, you mean this one?
No,
any comedy festival.
First festival I did was the Winnipeg Comedy Festival. Okay. I got it from doing a show at the Underground Comedy Club, which is like a weed friendly venue in Toronto.
Okay.
And Boyd Banks, a true comics comic in Toronto, he boasts about being banned from most of the clubs in the country. And Boyd would host a show every 2 weeks at the Underground, and occasionally he would be high on mushrooms when he hosted. And I'm probably talking out of school, but Boyd won't mind. It was actually right after Irwin Barker, who the Homegrown Award is named after here at Just for Laughs. Irwin Barker passed from cancer, I think, in 2011. And comics came from all over the country into Toronto to go to his memorial and funeral. And Boyd had a show that same weekend. So at the memorial, he invited like all the old comics out to his weed show.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier in the week, he had asked me to come do a spot at the show, but we were both smoking pot, so he forgot. And I showed up to the show, and Boyd was like, "Oh, I totally forgot I booked you." And he also had a friend who had a collection of the different uniforms from different jobs.
Okay.
So he was wearing like a vintage Dickie D ice cream man uniform also. So Boyd's dressed as the ice cream man, and he's like... he's played a featured zombie in several George Romero flicks. Like, he's a very interesting looking guy.
Okay. Boy.
And he's like, "Babe, I totally forgot I booked you." He's "Let me see where I can fit you on," and he disappears. And then he comes back. He's like, "I'm gonna have to put you on at the end." I think he told me I was following like Mike Wilmot and Tim Steeves or some crazy combination of Canadian guys who've been doing it far longer than me. He always did that to me. Boyd would forget he booked me, and then I'd show up. Or he was just, you know, giving me trial by fire, but he might have been pretending to forget. But every time I showed up, he was like, "Oh, I totally forgot you're on the show. So I'm going to put you after Kenny Robinson and Scott Thompson," you know.
Okay.
Always big legendary guys.
And how was that on those occasions? How would you feel about that?
Well, at first I'd be like, "Ah, fuck," and then it's like, but then I do well. So,
and why would you do well?
Well, I mean, at that point when Boyd had that show going, I'd already figured out who I was. So it was, I had the material, and I had I was aware that I was the storyteller guy.
Okay.
So I wasn't worried about doing the time. It's just like, you never want to follow the killer, or, you know, a killer. I just wanted to work on new stuff today. Like, now I have to do the really good jokes.
Now you've got to bring your Wilmot following A-game.
And, so... that night after Irwin's memorial, he put me on last, and I did like a 15-minute bit about going to a swingers club with a random woman who'd approached me after a show, and it did well. And then afterwards, I met Al Ray, who's now Laura Ray. transitioned. But at the time, Al was artistic director of the Winnipeg Fest, and came up to me after the show, and we got to talking. And the whole point of the Winnipeg Fest is they do themed galas, so everyone's set is on a theme, and you know, like obviously you can talk for a long, long time on one subject. Mm-hmm. So do you have any more stories like that that are a bit shorter? And Al was, went to bat for me and got me into the 2011 Winnipeg Fest. Doing the story from the album about setting my house on fire.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
I did that bit on the Misfortune. That was it. Misfortune Tellers was the clever name. Okay. It was all stories about bad luck.
Okay.
Or all bits of material about bad luck. So I'd had the misfortune of setting my parents' kitchen on fire. But so that had been my first festival.
And when you're assembling a story, when you're polishing a story, what sorts of things are you, or when you're kind of selecting a story, are there things that strike you as, this is particularly me? Like, this is a particularly K. Trevor Wilson take on a subject, or it's a particularly you approach to the telling of the story?
I mean, if it makes me laugh, I'm going to try to do it on stage now. Like, that's just sort of the rule. Like, I have to warn my friends sometimes, like, this is going to be a bit, because it's really funny what's happening right now. It's going to come out sounding like me because I'm telling it.
Okay. And what are the, I mean, is there any kind of conscious decision making in, like, when you're honing a story? If you've got something, you're like, okay, that works. Mm-hmm. Do you ever sit down and rough it out on a bit of paper and go?
I always work it out on stage.
Okay.
On stage, or, you know, like with people, like with other, in conversation with comics, but mostly it's on stage that I take the idea on there and just start talking it out and seeing what hits. And then, you know, sometimes, you know, buddy will come in and be like, oh, you know, like, here's a tag, or say this instead of that. Mm. But with any story, because the first story I really did on stage was the fire story, setting my parents' kitchen on fire, because it happened in my second year of college, and my folks were on vacation in Cuba with my brother and my younger brother and sister. And I had some friends over because they left us all this food, and I was like, you know, let's cook up this food because they're coming back tomorrow. And that's when we were cooking French fries, and fucking went outside, came in, it was on fire. And my one buddy had actually gone to the store to get buns and came back, and the fire department was in there, and he was like, I just went to the fucking store. When did this fire happen? And like, everything about it was just so ridiculous, and it had happened, you know, like, with two friends there. So the next time we were all hanging out, you know, my friends were like, Trevor, you got to tell them about the fucking, you trying to kill us in your fucking kitchen. And it just became the story that I had to tell at every party about burning down my parents' kitchen. And the whole neighborhood came out. Because we were standing on the lawn, and there's three fire trucks in front of the house, so all the neighbors are coming out, and they're, you know, like, they're all coming up to me like, what happened? And it's like, I don't know, these firemen just came into my house. Like, what do you think happened? Like, and you know, I remember, and my parents had just remodeled the kitchen too, so oh. The questions everyone was asking was like, the new kitchen? It's like, no, somehow they destroyed the old kitchen. And then the other question, everyone was like, are your parents still in Cuba? And it's like, they're in a plane now, coming back.
And
I have set fire to their house. On the upside, with the insurance money, they were able to replace the wallpaper that they previously couldn't afford to replace in the dining room.
Every clout?
Because it was silk wallpaper that my mom had gotten on sale from B.B. Bargoon's when they were going out of business. And she was never going to get silk wallpaper at that price again. my mom's friend started asking me to come over and cook French fries in their bathroom so they could get the new toilet. And my dad got the fridge he wanted because the he got the fridge with ice that makes its own ice.
Ah.
Which is, I think that was my dad's life goal for a long time, to have a fridge.
I'm the same with the corner sofa.
And I want a bed that tilts.
That'll be all right. So what? How much of...
When I put it on stage, it wasn't funny on stage.
Okay.
It was funny at parties, but on stage, it was lacking. Over time, because it took me about a full year to make it funny, and it was learning that I didn't have to tell every part of the story.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, absolutely.
Because, like, we have this need, you know, sort of feeling that we have to be honest about everything, but being honest and giving every detail are different. And so I started realizing if it's not funny, I can just cut it out. Like, it doesn't have to be in there. Because I was talking about my two friends being there with me when I set the house on fire.
Yes, sure.
And, my one friend was in the other room watching TV. And I used to, in the story, you know, talk about going to get Jen and being like, there's an emergency. And she was like, oh, but there's a really good Friends on. And, and as much as they were like, I enjoyed it, it never worked with the audience.
So yeah,
like,
because the jeopardy has to be you've done this on your own.
Yeah, so... So Jen and Andrew were removed from the story because they weren't funny. I'm sorry, guys. It was just the reality. Like, if it's not funny, and if it's not moving the story forward, if it's just like useless exposition, get rid of it because it's just eating up. It's just eating up time and attention. And then once I'd taken all the stuff that wasn't funny and wasn't necessary to the story, I was left with like a pretty good bit, and then I started filling it in with jokes. Then, like, you know, it's like, okay, well, like, I can make a joke about this thing there, make a joke here, and then, like, what's the best way to compare this? Like, what is the best way to establish this visual? Like, what's the funniest way to say a fireball came out of the top of the pot, and then I just started adding things like that, you know, hadn't previously been there. Like, none of the firemen ever called me a fucking idiot.
Sure.
But it's funny if they did.
Sure.
The cop did suggest I just have a salad. Like, that part was 100% real, but God bless that cop for making it a very bad joke at someone's expense. It was wholly unprofessional of that police officer, but did help the bit out immensely. And it was, you know, I found myself over-explaining the bit, and once I took it down to just exactly what it needed to be, and then just filling it with jokes, it took off running. It got me a festival. I actually at one point had a company that sells fire safety equipment asked me if they could use the joke, a recording of their joke in their fire extinguisher safety classes as a demonstration of why fire extinguishers are important.
Yeah. did you let them?
I did. It's like, as long as you purchase the album, that's fine. Because they really didn't have a business model, and I didn't have any sort of business model to be like, how do I lease you my fucking
business? Yeah, sure.
Like, how do I enforce this? Like,
yeah. As I understand it, one of the things that a lot of Canadians do is leave. A lot of Canadian comics leave.
Yeah.
People go out, they come to the UK or they go to the States, and then they come back. Did you do that? Have you always stayed in Toronto?
I've never moved. I've never lived in a different city. I've lived in Toronto my whole life. I've thought about it. Like, for a while, when like the acting was quiet, there seemed to be more work out in Vancouver, and I thought about going out there. But then there'd always be like something would happen that would keep me at home. I've gone down to the States a few times, like mostly LA, to visit, and I like visiting, but I don't feel as comfortable there.
Okay. What's that about?
Well, part of it is because by the time I started to go down there, I had so much going on in Canada that going down there, I was like, I was twiddling my thumbs. Like I was bored. I could get on shows, but not enough to keep myself occupied. And I didn't have anything to do really during the day. Cause I was just visiting and I didn't have, a life there. And the people I knew all were doing shit. And I was just, I was just antsy. My family's in Toronto. Now I got a girl in Toronto. It's, there's a lot of anchors and I feel like when I was going down to LA, I was going down there to try to get more work, but I was turning down work to go to LA.
Yeah.
To try to get work. So it's like, well, that's counterproductive. Like, I'm just going to take this work.
Yeah.
So I
feel like I understand all those reasons, but I think it's interesting that you said you didn't feel comfortable there.
Yeah. Every time I go back, I know more and more people. And it's easier to make plans. It's easier to go out for lunch with somebody. And I know the city better, so I can... I can figure out where I am. I can navigate. Going down to LA, staying at a friend's house or an Airbnb, and while it's nice, sometimes I'd rent an apartment with like a couple dudes, and we'd all be like splitting one one apartment in LA for a while, and. It was just like, I don't have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't, you don't seem to, or do you have that same kind of wanderlust that a lot of comedians have? Like when you hear about maybe you're doing enough traveling within Canada, it's big enough, you can just be on the road a lot. But I think one of the things that comedy affords us is the ability to travel and see the world.
I love the road. I love the road. I love the fact that I get paid to go all over the place. And I especially love it when it's a place I never thought about going to.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go there and you find out it's just lovely. I love that shit. But, I've also got a desire for something that resembles a normal life. I like going on the road, but I also like coming home and having a stretch. I don't mind being in one place for a certain amount of time too. And the TV show is kind of good because I get to be in one place, but I'm still on the road because we shoot on location.
Yes.
So
this is Letterkenny.
Yeah, yeah.
And tell us a little bit about that, because I remember you mentioning it last time, or someone mentioning it about you, and I've only just caught, I just literally caught the first, I would recommend anyone listening to this, just watch the first 5 minutes of the first episode. It's available online. The writing is fantastic.
Oh, Jared and Jacob, who've written probably 80% of the episodes, they know what they're doing. Well, they got an award for it. They won the Writers Guild of Canada Award and a Canadian Screen Award for best writing on a comedy. We actually picked up best television comedy at the CSAs this year.
Awesome.
Which is...
Okay. And how did you get involved with that project? Did they know you?
I knew the producers.
Okay.
New Metric Media, Mark and Pat, who run that... I met them here, actually, at Just for Laughs years ago, and they approached me after seeing my stand-up and asked me to develop an idea for a show based on my comedy to pitch them. And I pitched them a couple ideas here and there, and nothing that they ever really, really wasn't the right fit, but they still very much wanted to work together. And Letterkenny started out, was originally as a Twitter account called Listy Problems.
Okay.
Run by two friends, Jared Kiso and his best friend Jordan, about their hometown of Listowel, Ontario, which is like out in Kitchener-Waterloo area, town of 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. Farming community mostly, and also got a lot of churches from what I remember. It's got like way too many churches for the amount of people that live in Listowel. And they had this Twitter account where they just wrote, you know, fake problems that people from Listowel might complain about. And Jared noticed one day that they had 15,000 followers for a account making fun of a town of 5,000 people. So he's like, so there's a bit of a bigger market than just Listowel.
Yeah.
For small town kind of stuff. So Jared was an actor. Jordan was not in the business. So Jared asked Jordan if he could take the concept and turn it into sketches. So Jared wrote out a series of sketches that were Letterkenny problems, and an extension of the Listowel problems idea, but they took the name Letterkenny, the Irish town of Letterkenny, of course. But there was also briefly a Letterkenny, Ontario, which was a mining town, which is now pretty much abandoned. It's just, there's like the small remnants of Letterkenny left there. So it was a real sounding place that we couldn't get in trouble for, or that he couldn't get in trouble for using, roughly from around the same region. So a good, fake location. And the original sketches were Jared and his best friend Nathan Dales doing like straight to camera, just alternating, giving examples of small town Letterkenny problems. Okay. And they took off. Like those sketches started getting like crazy hits. I think it's like 400 million views a piece at this point.
Jesus.
On those two sketches. But they started taking off, and Jared wrote two more sketches. And one was the hockey players, and they got two buddies of theirs who were at one point hockey players but had left to pursue acting. And they played two hockey players, dating the small-town farm girls, pulling up to the farm and getting into a chirp battle with Jared and Nathan, where they just go back and forth with insults, and the Hicks, of course, decimate the hockey players. And then they did another one, which was the produce stand, which is where a guy, a filthy skid from the city, so, all decked out in his emo death punk wear, comes up to the produce stand asking for organic vegetables, and, two small town farmers go to town on with the city guy. And I actually first discovered the sketches on Funny or Die.
Okay.
They'd been uploaded there under the header of Canadian as Fuck. And stumbled across them and really enjoyed them and thought they were terrific sketches. And then, one day as it goes, I get an email from my agent saying I've got an audition for this new show, Letterkenny. And I was like, is this the Canadian as Fuck guys? And they sent me some clips of the sketches to watch, to see what the guy's pacing is. And I was like, oh, fuck, this is Letterkenny Problems. They're doing a TV show.
That's so great. Normally when people end up involved in projects, the people that end up involved in the projects that already exist are people who don't care about them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, there's not many people in the Avengers movies actually read comic books.
Yeah.
So it's really lovely to kind of have a thing where you've gone, I'm really into this. Oh, is it that?
Yeah,
and you're perfect
for
it, possibly because you yourself are Canadian as fuck.
It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt. Yeah, no, it was, I got, the audition came across my desk, and I was like, I think I'm actually going to really try for this one. Like, I think this is one I want to do. So I put in the work because their dialogue is so fast.
It's so fast.
The dynamic that Nate and Jared already had was so quick, and I knew I knew I was going to have to fit into that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I couldn't bring them something so different that it didn't fit in. So yeah. I had to take what I did and make it work for what they wanted to do. So I really watched the videos and I went over the script and just sped up my pacing. But, you know, while trying not to lose my, you know, my voice per se.
Sure.
And it worked out. I did the audition, and I only did one audition. There was no callback. And the role was originally written with another actor in mind, who actually, Dan Petronevich, who plays McMurray on the show, which is why the character was named Dan. It was named after Petronevich. And but they decided that they wanted, you know, the third guy to be something different from the other two guys, and so being like large and hairy, you know, I had physically a different look, and then, you know, I had the deep barrel voice, and then when we really started going with Dan, I sort of added the element of messing up the occasional word here and there, which was kind of like they wrote sort of that small town accent, because there's the distinct, when you get outside of the cities, there's, you know, there's a lot of plurals where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that's sort of the French influence, where, you know, like just over the years, so many, like it's just worked into the sort of Canadian lexicon, because when French people learn English, they tend to have plurals where they shouldn't be, because of the way they pluralize words in the French language. Okay. So like, you know, they would add an S to you where it doesn't need to be, and everyone in small town Canada says yous.
Okay, yeah.
What can I get you guys for dinner?
Yeah.
And, so there's a bit of that written into the script, but I, like, most of my stand-up career have been in small towns at this point, because that's where you don't make your money in big cities. You play there maybe twice a year, but it's going around and doing Legion halls and hockey arenas that you really make most of your money when you're starting out. And every small town I'd gone to, you meet a series of guys who just have no idea what words are supposed to be. And just like amazing malapropisms, yeah, completely by accident. My buddy texts me some still, because he's got like a lot of friends who from small towns from out in the country, and he goes, when I have these conversations, but you're not going to believe what they say sometimes. It was like his one buddy, they were at a funeral, and his one friend's going down the line to the family and saying, sorry for your lost.
Sorry for your lost. Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
My one friend is like, because my buddy was walking with a limp, and I asked him what was going on, and he said that he bunged up his knee and the doctors got him on anti-flaminories.
Okay. But you're in a position now, presumably, where because you have like several series, it's been recommissioned again, is it? They've ordered another?
Yeah. We're in the middle of our third season, okay. But the first two seasons were 6 episodes, and season 3 is 18. So we're technically doing 3 seasons.
Oh, amazing.
In 1 year this year.
And you're in that position that comedians are desperate to be in, where you're effectively playing a version of your stand-up persona. Yeah. So fans of the show will want to come and see you being you.
It Squirrely Dan was described in the breakdown as a burly storyteller.
Yeah.
And like some of the stories I've done on the show were real stories of friends of mine.
Okay.
That just hadn't made stand-up yet.
Yeah. So does it, I know we must wrap up shortly, but just to pull it together, does that mean that there is kind of pressure on you, or do you feel any pressure to go, there's an opportunity here to really take the stand up to the next level and not spend another 17 years writing the next album?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm recording another album this year.
Oh, amazing.
Already. We're putting together a Letterkenny Live tour.
Oh, man, that's going to be
fun. And taking the show on the road
next
year.
That's a real dream. Get the character you can play that's like you.
And, well, the best part is I'm doing the character, but I'm also doing stand-up on the show. So amazing. I get to do both. And we had some debate on how to play it, but I was like, I want K. Trevor Wilson the stand, because they were like, we were like writing in a joke that I was my own character's identical cousin, and I was like, no, fuck it, like Squirrely Dan is Squirrely Dan, K. Trevor Wilson's K. Trevor Wilson, and actually in the live show I do jokes as Squirrely Dan about not being a very big fan of K. Trevor Wilson.
Yeah, that's smart. That's a really smart way to do it, because there is a danger there that you become too enmeshed in it.
At the end of the show, because Mark Ford and I do stand up on the show, he plays the hockey coach at Letterkenny, so we both do stand up, and then I do sort of scenes from the show with Nate and Jared. And Jared, at the end of the show, goes, you know, another round of applause for Mark Forward. And I go, yeah, but that K. Trevor Wilson wouldn't shut the fuck up. And it gets a good laugh from the crowd, but like I get to do both. And and the idea is that doing the Letterkenny Live tour will then help me do my own, move my show from the clubs into theaters. And then I get to do my own. My own tours after that, and then I can, make more money faster.
Yeah, that's what it's about. That's great. So finally then, do you have any, are there any things you'd have done differently? Because it seems like you're in a really good position now. You're in a really strong position. You're respected as a stand-up. You've got the TV show, the live tour to go with it. But the trunk of the tree is your stand-up comedy. Is there anything that you'd have done differently to get here?
You know, it, like, hindsight's always 20/20, but the stuff that really pushed me along, there was no way of predicting that they were going to happen. And also, it took me so long to get there that by the time I got there, I was overly prepared. Whereas if the success had happened quicker, I don't know if I would have been as ready for it and able to capitalize on it successfully. So, no.
That's great to hear. What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
I'm with Stupid and an arrow pointing to the guy next to me.
Thanks, Trev.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So that was Trevor, K. Trevor Wilson there. What a glorious gentleman he is. You can still listen to Sex Cop Fire Penis, if I remember correctly, was the name of that album that we were discussing. I highly recommend just checking him out on YouTube as well. There's umpteen little clips there. He's done hundreds of comedy festivals, all sorts of little televised appearances here and there. His first special, Bigger in Person, debuted on the Comedy Network, so I'm sure you can track that down. He's also one of the judges in Roast Battle Canada and has done Jimmy Kimmel and bits and bobs like that all over, all sorts of TV spots. So check him out. He's just a joy. Thank you very much to K. Trevor Wilson for coming on the show. Thank you to you, the listener, for waiting 5 years for me to get the episode out. Thank you to Nathan for producing the show, Nathan Wood. Thank you to Jake Crossland for logging it. And Pete Dobbing is your podcast consultant who will be joining me on our mission to Austin, Texas. Also, this show exists purely to stimulate the personal growth of Mr. Brett Goldstein. That's all for now. I will speak to you soon, but now I'll post amble at you. So go away or stick around for that. Bye for now. So let me briefly thank everybody that came along to the Leicester Comedy Festival show that I did, which was rescheduled after I got COVID and maintained an impressive viral load, which meant that for some reason when I got COVID, I thought, you know, it says if you test negative after 5 days, if you test negative 2 days concurrently, then or consecutively, one after another, concurrently. That's at the same time, isn't it? Don't do two at the same time, that'd be wrong. Basically, if you do two negative tests over 48 hours, you can go. So for some reason, I just thought, well, I don't feel like I've got it much. I dare say I'll be out of here on day five. But it was not to be. I ended up being completely COVIDed for 10 days. So apologies if you were one of the people who was going to do one of the things, if you're going to attend one of the many things I had to cancel. And thank you very much if you came back to that Leicester Comedy Festival show. Exciting news about Edinburgh, but nothing I can say. But exciting news about Edinburgh, so that's good. And not for any real reason, but, you know, just I'll wait until we're officially releasing something. Going to need a title. So that is all hands to the pumps, which I think is going to make me feel a bit more like a human being, I hope. I've just been absolutely laced and riddled with anxiety of late. I've been doing really well. And then for some reason, I think it was having COVID. And then I'll tell you what it was. It was a week or 10 days of COVID and being at home and thinking, I mean, God, if you'd seen me tweeting on day one going, hey, guys, tell me your favourite time travel movies. And then everyone kindly did that. And I watched half of one movie and then my entire family got COVID and we suddenly kicked into a very different version of isolation. Just on the subject of what people can get up to with their isolation, I saw on Twitter today that John Robertson of The Dark Room and a friend of the podcast, at Robotron on social media and probably Twitch as well, almost certainly, raised over £100,000 sterling for charity over the last 2 years. What an absolute hero. And I was looking at that going, God, why didn't I do that? And then I thought, oh no, I've got children. But that's no excuse, is it, when people are putting themselves out there. And, you know, that's a mindset thing, isn't it? Anyway, I started off talking about feeling anxious. And now I'm wobbling that other people are doing more work for charity than I am. But all I'm saying on that brief tangent there is bloody well done, John. Isn't that incredible? What an achievement. You should definitely follow him across all forms of thing. I had COVID for 10 days and then I came out of that sort of dovetailed with half term. And so I've been doing loads of parenting for half term. I feel like I've barely worked, and I think that's why I've gone mad. So let's call that resolved. Thank you, listener, for allowing me to reach that conclusion, giving me a focus to say that out loud and let me reach that conclusion. Now, this won't be the first time I've said this during a postamble, but am I going fucking mad? Is it healthy to sit in a cellar, which, and I don't know if I've mentioned this before, every so often when I've been doing kind of webcam-based things over the last 2 years, I've been whinging about the fact that I have to sit and work in my cellar because I live in a house in Bristol that my wife owns. And as a result, we've got a cellar. And I only realised very, very recently that it's a boast if you're talking to someone in London. I've been going, oh, poor me, working in my cellar. And anyone listening on the London end of it is thinking, ooh, harking in with his cellar. But I'm sitting in it now. And I've done everything, not everything I can, but most things I can to make it livable. It's bloody freezing. And I just think I'm sitting in it quietly going mad on my own. And I've got a horrible feeling that were I to be writing some sort of as yet unannounced Edinburgh show, then I would. There's a horrible feeling that day one, I'd get up there and kind of look in my notebook and go, oh, it just says all work and no play over and over and over and over again. Because I think I might be losing my mind. I don't know. Are these postambles? Hey, are you a qualified psychological professional? A professional in the terms of psychology, not simply a psychological professional, because aren't we all? But is this healthy to be sitting, talking to people that aren't even here, alone, in my cellar? I don't know. This is what I was going to talk to you about. I was going to say, is this it? Is this the famous podcast burnout? Because blow me tight, it's been 10 years. And I know I haven't post-ambled for all of them. But I don't know if it's helping me keep my mind together or actively helping it fall apart. Maybe I should script these. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just laziness and the fact that I'm not scripting my little... I like my private chat with you at the end of the episode. I don't want to script it. I could probably do a couple of bullet points. But anyway, you would miss out on, and I have no data. I'm sure I could find it, but I daren't. No data on how many of you even listen to this bit, but bloody well done if you are, because I don't make it easy for you. I I've messed up the timing. This is it. My mind's falling apart to the extent that, along with doing some work in London this morning where I didn't know there was a tube strike and I got the wrong hotel. I was being all clever with the hotel so that I could just walk to the venue in 2 minutes, and I ended up accidentally getting a venue a half-hour walk away and then panicking because there was no public transport running. And it's quite a fun way to be in London when literally everyone in London is on the street because there's no public transport. So much as I missed that fair city, it was nice to do that. And then I concluded that engagement and had to get from Bank to Paddington, which is 4.5 miles on foot, and I had to drag a suitcase the entire way. But it's a good time to listen to that Jim Gaffigan album, because I do find it very hard to sit down and listen to a thing. I mean, everyone does. No one sits there like some bloke in a art house movie putting on their headphones and just going to listen to an album. Do you do that? That's obviously mad to me. That's as mad as relaxing in the bath. Totally impossible. So I got two birds, three birds with one stone. I travelled from A to B, did that day's exercise, piss off, 4.5, and the half an hour. There's got to be 5 miles of walking, dragging a suitcase. That's at least equivalent to a HIIT workout or a, you know, some sort of gentle yoga with Adrienne experience. So if it doesn't count as excellent exercise, it's certainly no worse than my current daily practice. So I did that, and then I also listened to the Jim Gaffigan thing. So that was great. Really, I really recommend Mr. Universe. Properly, properly funny. But the point that I'm making, that was an example of how my mind's falling apart. And another example is this. I had meticulously planned the release schedule of this podcast such that episode 400 would go out next week, at the same time as this show turns 10 years old. And I fucked that up as well. So I basically, I've got this 3 more episodes now. And so the timing would never have worked. And I can't understand how I've done it. But what it amounts to is that next week is going to be Mystery Guest X, who I will not say because they're not yet in the can. But once they are in the can, I will immediately rush that episode out. And that's someone who should have been on the pod for a long time. So that'll be fun. And then we'll do Mr. Jim Gaffigan, assuming that everything in the South by Southwest goes well. And then we will do Dulcie Sloan. And then it will be episode 400, which I think will be released on the 31st of March, which at least means I'm in the 10th birthday month. So that means I've just sort of scraped it, and that's technically a win. But what it means is that next week, when I should be celebrating with you the 10th birthday of the show, I'm just going to have to shut up about it. And you know how hard I find that. So we'll have to wait until the end of March. And then what are we going to do by way of the birthday celebrations? The episode with Rob is in the can, and it's a 2-hour doozy. So I'm not concerned about that content-wise. It's got everything. It's got, you know, Rob's culture vulture appraisal of what's happened in comedy over the last 30 or 40 years. That's brilliant. And some really good stuff about running and slogging and endurance and commitment and all sorts of great, great episode. Really pleased with it. And of course, Rob, you remember, was my guest for episode 1. So it's a lovely sort of 10 year on thing. But is there, I mean, should I get a cake? What do you do? How does one celebrate the 10th birthday of a podcast? Fortunately, thanks to me cocking up the release schedule, we have time to find out. So please, answers on an electronic postcard to stuart@comedianscomedian.com or indeed via at comcompod on Twitter. Don't bother with Instagram. I exist there, but I can't bear to look at it. And ditto TikTok, on which I don't exist. And do remember, you can get in touch with me on LinkedIn. If you're a business person and you want me to come along and talk brilliantly about resilience from the perspective of the comedy industry and comedians, then find me on LinkedIn and get in touch, or just email me stuart@comedianscomedian.com, because that at the moment is largely everything that's keeping me sane. I don't think my mind's falling apart, but I tell you what, it takes 2 weeks of only half working and only half achieving to suddenly kick down the house of cards that is my fragile mental state. And suddenly I'm literally biting my fingernails. So if anyone has any advance on some hilarious looking polyvagus nerve stretching exercises that I encountered on YouTube recently, send them my way as well. That'll do for now. Have a wonderful life. And let's hope that all the worst things in the world that are happening at the moment don't become even worse, as they might. Love to you and your loved ones. And I'll speak to you, the universe willing, next week. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.